Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with Muslim feminist Soraya M. Dean. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. With the raging war in the Middle East, peace may seem impossible. But there are glimmers of hope, shining spirits who work relentlessly to fulfill a grand vision of goodwill and compassion between ancient cousins to build a better, kinder world for this generation and for generations to come. Soraya M. Dean is one of those visionaries, a Muslim activist who seeks to build bridges, fight hate, and foster understanding based on shared values of the Quran and the Torah, values that honor coexistence and respect among peoples and nations. Today, Soraya and I will explore the power of interfaith dialogue to change the incendiary discourse and create mutual understanding that may just lead to a future of peace. Soraya M. Dean is an award-winning Muslim feminist. She is a lawyer, interfaith advocate, international activist, community organizer, and a public speaker. A native of Sri Lanka, Soraya is the co-chair of the Women's Working Group of the International Religious Freedom Roundtable in DC and chairs the International Religious Freedom Roundtable in Sri Lanka. Soraya is currently reading for her public leadership credentials at Harvard University. Soraya, thank you for all your sincere and loving support for Israel and the Jewish people. It can't be understated how important your voice for peace really is.
Thank you, Shauna. I would say shalom aleikum. We can put salam and shalom together and greet each other by saying shalom aleikum.
Shalom aleikum. I always think in my mind how similar, obviously similar, those two sounds are, right? Both meaning like come in peace, basically. And that if there's ever proof of just how close our two nations really are, our two people, that these words that are so important and potent to both of our cultures are almost exactly the same. And I think that this is something that is so lost in today's discourse is the understanding all humans, any two humans on earth share more in common than we have in differences.
Yes, so true, so true. So before I begin, Shauna, I want to touch on two things. One is to remember the hostages. I wear this pin. I believe that if Hamas had not desecrated Islam, taking hostages, women, children, and the elderly, and the sick, we would not be here. So this is a very strong call to the Muslim community to call on Hamas to release the hostages. And it is also a reminder that on October 8th, if the Muslims had stood up and called on Hamas to release the hostages, we would not be in this war today. And when Hamas used the word Al-Aqsa flood, they desecrated Islam because Al-Aqsa is the third holiest place for Muslims. And when they used Al-Aqsa and when they used the term flood, in the world of violent extremism, we know that the word flood is beyond the English definition of the word flood. It meant a continuous flow of blood. It means, so when they say Al-Aqsa flood, they're using the women and the children as fodder, as sheaves. And I want to recognize that fact for the pain this has caused to everybody. You know, like we spoke a little while ago, families are divided, communities don't talk anymore, Terrorism is rampant. Security in my country, where I love and live, the United States, is under attack. They have disseminated lives for us, and they're doing it with the least effort. In that, the collateral is innocent Palestinians. And I think we should recognize that. And
I thank you. Yes.
Secondly, Shauna, because of your podcast, the name is very, very dear to me, the Yoga of War. I am a woman from South Asia who believes in yoga, the union of the mind and the body. And I think every day, every one of us who wake up, we are in a battlefield, a mental battlefield. And it is so important for us to take an inventory of what is happening in our mind, which is the battlefield. Because this battlefield, Shauna, we are in it. We don't visit it occasionally. We are in this battlefield. So how we process what is happening in a wholesome, humanistic way is very important for us to produce that world we want to create for our children and for ourselves. And an analogy would be, you see the world we are creating in a mirror sometimes. And the mirror is a reflection of what is within us. So what the world needs to understand is that we don't go clean the mirror. We have to clean within ourselves. And that, I believe, is a very serious call for every one of us, including me. That is work in progress. And we what we do is we reflect on within what is lacking in me that I have to think this way. Well, how can I lead with love? And then to create a blueprint. And we all mourn the war. Whoever said it's okay to be in a war state? You know, I just put a post yesterday. In war, war is determined not by who's right, but who is left. You know, Bertrand Russell says that. So our goal should be moving forward to call on Hamas to release the hostages, end this war, and alleviate the suffering of the Palestinians. And as we bring together, if possible, I don't even know anymore what is possible. You know, all I know is that I love people. I love everybody. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for bringing the hostages into this discussion. This is our 24/7 as we close in, I believe, tomorrow on 700 days. And also, you are the first person to actually interpret the name Yoga of War. Usually people are asking me, like, what on earth is the Yoga of War? Because it seems like such a contradiction in terms. And I love what you said about the holistic mind and body approach to cleansing from inside. I'll tell you the truth, that the evolution of the name was actually a reference to the Bhagavad Gita. That literally says that if your family is threatened, it's not your choice, but your obligation to defend them. And this was the word of Krishna, of the representation of God, however people wish to interpret it, that he also, that Arjuna had a choice of all the men and all the beasts to fight with, or just God, and he chose God and he won. So it's such a beautiful text, and that was the inspiration for the title. But I love that you offered your own. Thank you so much. What a beautiful way to start this conversation. So Soraya, you honestly, I'm a YouTube like junkie. I'm not a big podcast person listener because I like seeing people's faces. I like getting the essence of who they are beyond just a voice. And I have to say that not just listening to the gentleness of your voice, but watching you, you are a beacon of light. And you're a beacon of light in a world that right now, if I'm completely honest, feels quite oppressively dark. I want to start out with you telling us a bit about what it is that inspired you to advocate specifically, I know you advocate for a lot of things, but for interfaith cooperation, communication, and understanding, particularly with the Jewish people. You didn't choose an easy task here.
Thank you for that great question. It goes deep into my journey of activism. On you know, after September 11th, Shauna, the Muslims were viewed it with a lot of suspicion, and there was a lot of disconnection in the United States. So it was during this time my 7-year-old son was bullied. He was called a terrorist, and that particular day, I went to school to pick him up, and he comes to me with his heavy bag on his shoulders, and he asks me, "Mommy, are we all terrorists?" So that was a defining moment in my life. And that is also a defining moment in my life to really, like what the Jewish people are going through now, is to take decisive action against hate that is being proliferated and that is being legitimized. So I felt very scared. I felt very vulnerable. I didn't know what to do. I went home and I knew this required more than only the Muslims to address. Like I think Rabbi Sacks says, anti-Semitism is a virus that the Jewish people alone can't address. It has to be from other people who have to call these out. So it was such a moment for me. And I went to the computer and I Googled interfaith organizations and I found some leading interfaith organizations in the San Fernando Valley where I was living at that time. My son is 7. He was bullied. He was told all Muslims are terrorists. And my words and my work at that moment will be the most defining story I can tell him, because I didn't want him to live in fear, and nor did I want America to be put into this pigeonhole of this is a country that is bad for Muslims. It's not. Because I love this country, and this is a country my children are growing. I keep remembering that all the time. So I was looking for this interfaith organization, and I met the Valley Interfaith Council. It was the largest interfaith network. And there I met the board chair, Marsha Novak. She and I formed a relationship instantly, and we worked a lot. And it was the Jewish people in Los Angeles who held us Muslims with the greatest of love and care. Fast forward to many years later, Marsha and I together founded the Interfaith Solidarity Network that was bringing all communities together. We organized marches, Shana, where 1,000 people marched for a cause. We would stop at the synagogue. We would stop at the mosque. We would stop at the church. That was the caliber and the level of interfaith solidarity that existed in Los Angeles. So therefore, I grieve for that. That's another reason that I pushed myself so hard to bring the Jews and the Muslims together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, go on, sorry.
And when Paul Kessler was murdered on the streets of Thousand Oaks for carrying a Jewish flag, I reached out to the Muslim world communities and the leaders, and I said, "We have to condemn this. This is not right. This is not what our communal contracts are about. It's about watch for each other, love each other, defend each other." But nobody responded, and that told me there, Shana, that we are in a deep abyss. There's unexplainable levels of hostilities, and we have work to do.
Yes, we definitely do. And I also want to get into sort of the post 10/7 world that we're living in a little later in the discussion. But first, I want to get to know you a little better, or a lot better, because I find you so infinitely fascinating. So you've done amazing work with the interfaith. I do have a quick question about how much of it is Jewish Muslim versus Jewish Christian Muslim, or Christian Muslim, or Jewish Christian. You're in this group. What would you say? Is it Is it sort of about everybody coming together, or because the Jewish-Muslim relationship seems to be at a real crisis, is that sort of the crux of primarily your focus at this time?
No, certainly not. Though it is largely, but we have to bring all faith communities together. Because when we all stand in solidarity, you know, there's power in what we can do, what we can say. I believe that all of us, but my focus is also more specifically in a sense to bring Jews and Muslims together, but I believe that we should bring all together.
And I believe that as well. So just encouraging interfaith dialogue in our incredibly stratified society right now is already far above and beyond, given like today's socio-political climate. But Soraya, if I may, you've really taken it one step, or I might even say many steps further, by also speaking quite loudly and defiantly against Islamic terror and also anti-Semitism. I'm wondering, I know you just said that when you reached out for support after Paul Kessler was murdered, that no one stood up. But what has been the general response of the broader Muslim community to your advocacy when it does cross that line into self-criticism? Now, when I say self, obviously I'm not talking about you, but that there is a terrorist element within your community that you find intolerable. And I use the word community loosely. I'm sorry. I mean within the broader Islamic umbrella.
So
Because to me, community is the people you choose, not necessarily the people who the world defines you as.
this has several intersections, Shana. There's not one answer. To begin with, you know, there's a tragic template of violence in the Muslim world, and most of it is driven by the Arab narrative. Okay? It has been taught, it has been fed. And we fail to realize that 63% of the Muslims live in Asia. 63%, yes. So it is the Arab narrative. Secondly, Palestine has become a symbol of moral identity for the Muslims. And I say this without any fear of or retraction. Palestinianism has become our new religion. So we are blinded by the need to question what is happening in the Middle East. And if you know, it is the silence that is deafening in the Muslim world that we have failed to call out Hamas. So October 7th, there has been what I'm understanding is that we have never resolved this. We had a superficial kind of a conversation. Because the Arabs brought to this plate what is called Arab Nazism. And we know that in the mid-30s, this is what fueled and sustained, and this is what that spread the ideology. So I don't think the Jewish people have adequately addressed it. We thought this will go away. But we are now at a moment where we have to take layer by layer by layer. And engage in a process of education. And let's begin, I say, with the problems against the Jewish people. They are refugees. You know, if you have a little heart, you're going to look beyond this tiny plot of land that 50 Arab nations are fighting against the Jews. And Palestine was, we had Arab Palestines and Jewish Palestines. The Jews did not explain this to us. We thought Palestine became a cause, a political movement driven by the KGB and the Russians and Yasser Arafat in the 60s. So lots of things have not been clearly understood. And unfortunately, today, I must be very honest, the optics of the war, we are watching the war that is playing in our living rooms, is not helping it. Yes. So as I talk, I must also call. I'm a peace activist, you know. No matter what the military decisions are, no matter what the political decisions are, I want the war to end also. So this is very important for the work that we are doing. So to answer your questions, it has several dimensions, several intersections, and it's very complex.
Yeah, I the optics of the war are extraordinarily painful, but it is, in my opinion, Hamas started this war. It's within their power to release the hostages and end this war, but also to stop using their own people as human shields. If they really wanted, if they cared about the people of Gaza, they would end the war instead of relying on Israel to care more about their people than they do and to cease fire. But I don't want to get too deep into that.
Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
Unless there's something you feel like you need to add.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Hamas started this war, they must end this war. You know, it is up to them. Because what has happened is, what we are seeing is a level of demagoguery, you know, a prejudice, and people are not engaging in rational argument. So if 100 Muslims came together and called out Hamas, and that might be a lofty call, because look at countries like UK and France legitimizing a country at this time without a leadership, giving more ammunition to Hamas. So this is a very complex situation, Shana, and I agree with you 100%. Because I stand for the state of Israel, I love the Jewish people. I don't want them to be so misunderstood because of this war, because of what they're seeing about the war.
Soraya, I have to ask, when you say that, do you consider yourself a Zionist, or just you appreciate and love the existence of Israel?
Both. I am a Muslim Zionist. Why shouldn't I be? If I read the Quran, there I am 34 times the Jews are mentioned, Israelites, not once in the Palestine, because there was no Palestine to mention, you know. So yes, Zionism, simply put, is where Jews are seeking for a homeland. And that particular call for a homeland was contaminated by the Arabs in the mid-30s, where the British had to train 20,000 Jews to defend themselves. Thereafter, it has been a continuous journey of defending themselves. So I tell the Muslims, don't tell me about what Zionism is. I know what it is. And it also shapes to the challenges it faces, you know. If you're going to attack the Jews with suicide bombing, they have to defend themselves. They have to get smarter. So it is not just about Zionism is that is political. Why not? Why shouldn't it be?
Yeah. May I ask if you or your family have been threatened in any way as a result of your activism? So I know you say that when you've reached out, the Muslim community has not stepped up to defend you, but have they just been quiet? Because there's an element, I think, like I see in the Jewish community, that people are afraid to speak up. And so I want to believe that most Muslims, just like most humans, right, stand on the side against terror, but it might be hard to speak up. But then there's also actual aggression. So is it passiveness? Is it aggression? Have you been threatened in any way? Do you still feel accepted by your community? Or have you been forced to find a new community, your people, your tribe?
Some of and all of the above. Last year, Shana, I was invited to speak at an international conference in Sri Lanka. That's where I'm from.
Yes.
And the Muslims wrote to the organizers and said, if she speaks, we are going to boycott the conference. So that is the level of aggression that is towards me. So I discussed this with my colleagues in the US, and they said, some said, don't go. Some said go. Then I wrote to the State Department. I wrote to the US Embassy. And I had to personally hire security guards to attend that conference. So if you ask if it is easy, no, it is not. There are days that I have cried because of the ostracization and the marginalization, all because we call out Hamas. We want the Palestinians to thrive, but you cannot in the Muslim world call out Hamas. So it is a terrible injustice that's happening towards us Muslim women today, a few of us. And I have to mention Anila. You know Anila, you had her in your podcast. She's a very courageous woman I look up to. We are partner. One day I cried to her. I said, Anila, I can't take this anymore. And we hug each other and we counsel each other because it's a very lonely place that we are today. And when she said, she invited a coalition of Muslim women to come together and we work together to address anti-Semitism, not only anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, hate. Our country doesn't deserve this, especially coming up from the Arab Americans, who none of them can go back to their countries today. So my call to them is, you support the country you live in, or you go back to the country you support. Don't desecrate and ruin America for my children, for our children who believe in carrying out our civic duties to this country.
Amen. Amen. It was wonderful to have Anila on the show. It's thanks to her that you're here with me today. So it's amazing to talk to such powerful and wonderful women. The truth is that very few women have been on the show, Muslim or otherwise, because the concept of war is such a male-dominated field. And it's very important that our voices are heard, because I think as women do come from a place where ultimately all we want is peace. We understand the necessity of war, but all we want is peace. And I think that is an inherent characteristic of a woman. I'm not saying no men want peace, but that there's certainly a different energy. But it makes me sad when you say that you have cried with her. In how hard and lonely this fight, believe me, I know, but at least I'm a Jew, so I've got sort of that in my corner. It's been a rough 23 months, but I'm wondering if the backlash has ever given you pause to think that perhaps this fight isn't even worth it.
On the contrary, it has given us more courage because these are things we warned 10, 15 years ago, Shana. This is not new to us.
Yes.
Our voices were stifled, not only within the community, but within our governments. We knew the rise of, who were the behind the rise of anti-Semitism in our country. I have to be very candid. This is one of the things I work with, is the theologically legitimized anti-Semitism. You know, after October 7th, I took my friend, Jewish rabbi. She lives five blocks from me. We walk together. She teaches me to play the guitar. And we have such a special relationship. And she told me, Soraya, let's go to the mosque, because she and I have been interfaith partners for a long time. So I go to the mosque and I sit. This is in Los Angeles, mind you. And the person who is preaching is talking about how Jews cannot be trusted in a very disparaging way. And I'm sure, Shana, if you were in a synagogue and if somebody spoke like that about the Muslims, you will stand on the chair and defend what is right. So
if I can interrupt you for 1 second, Soraya, I'm sorry, was this an actual service? Was it just a speaker? I mean, and by the way, let me just say, those words would never be spoken from a bima, period.
Yes.
I go on. What was the context? So you walked into a mosque. Was it a religious service? Was it a speaker? Was it a conference?
It was a Friday service. You know, like you have Saturday services, we have Friday, and the Christians have Sunday services. So after the service, I go meet the head of the mosque with my rabbi friend, and I ask him, why do you have to preach this? And he was saying something so disturbing that the community needs, are agitating for that kind of a message. And if you preach a peaceful message, it was a lame excuse. And then this is the part of the story where I want you to know more. So my friend went home, the rabbi friend, and she wrote a letter to the leader of the mosque. She said, I live 5 blocks from your mosque. I never felt so unsafe as I did in the mosque. That broke my heart. And I have watched and heard lot, sadly, we have a lot of religious leaders, Shana, unfortunately, who are versed in some form of cultural text, but they are not versed. They are not versed in the context. And I pledged that day, you know, this has to end. We have to call this madness, that we would bring 7th century theology. You know, there was a context that was revealed. You know, there was a lot of celebrations, and there was a lot of misunderstanding between the Jews and the Muslims at that time in Medina.
Yes.
Why are we preaching that here, which has no context? So I don't know where we Muslims will clear this, redeem ourselves from this mess. But in a, even though the Jewish community is going through all of this, I envy you, because you are doing, learning, and growing, and changing. I don't see that robust evolution, intellectual exploration in my community, and I grieve for that.
Soraya, my first instinct is to invite you to join me at a service on a Shabbat morning while you're back in LA. And my second instinct is that you've probably done that a million times before. But the reason why is, it's heartbreaking and crazy making, I have to be honest, that ever since 10/7, I've become so acutely aware of our Siddur, our prayer book. And I could tell you the one word that you see more than anything other than the name of God himself is the word shalom. That our entire service, and we're talking about a 3-hour service, so I don't know if you actually want to join me, but the whole service is about peace. It's all that's spoken during the sermons. It's all that we pray for in the level of misunderstanding about who the Jews are. And in this, yes, this includes Netanyahu, and it includes the IDF, and we function from a space of self-preservation, but also of peace. That is our greatest wish. And it would be a tremendous honor if when you're back in LA, if you would be at all interested in joining me in reading for yourself what maybe a conservative prayer book looks like, because obviously the reform is going to be a little different. So
may I accept that invitation, provided they have gefilte fish and some yummy food?
There won't be gefilte fish, but there will be the oodles of challah and candy.
Challah bread, okay.
Yeah, candies if there's a bar mitzvah, so you can throw it at the kid. We throw sweets when a child has a bar mitzvah, so there's lots of candies around. But I know that you will see the contrast, and it's really nothing but beautiful. And I think that's not because it's my religion. I think that's what religion is supposed to be.
I'm not surprised, Anna. After October 7th, we visited Israel, and we met many families, survivors. And I want to tell this particular story meeting Mirev. We met her about 5 miles from Gaza. We were to go to Gaza that day, but there was a breach of the ceasefire, and they said it was not safe. But Mirev came to see us. What is that city, Sderot? Sderot?
Sderot,
Okay, this is silent. Okay, so we saw the carnage, you know, we know what happened. So now Mirev was telling me, I have beautiful photographs with her. She is somebody that people need to hear. She was telling me how she was on the phone with her mother on October 7th. And the mother said to her, oh, I can hear Arab voices by the window, and she hung up. And later, the mother had shown up at the door and told her husband and her grandson to hide. And she told these terrorists, Hamas terrorists, that only she was poor. And of course, I don't know whether you want to hear this, they butchered her. They cut her into pieces. And a few doors next, I have to tell this story for the simple reason of this woman, how she was thinking, which is such an inspiration for us today. So a few doors next, her nephew was taken as hostage. Should I stop?
No, it's okay. Go on, please. People need to understand why this war is even occurring. People have no context, no understandings. Please go
People
on.
need to know why we stand up for this, for against Hamas to with the people of Israel. So then what happened was, they took her nephew, she lost two of her nephews that day. And here she tells us this story, and I'm ashamed. I'm embarrassed to hear these stories, because these were committed by men who call themselves Muslims. And then she is telling us, in that raw state of the event, oh, but it was not all Palestinians, it was Hamas. And how could she distinguish? I bet she was never taught to hate, you know. And the story was, a few days later, she got a text from Gaza. The old woman lied to us, we are coming to you. So meaning they took her mother's phone and they traced the call to her. And after they caused so much havoc and pain and grief to this lady, this sister of mine, who I can cry now. It's so painful. It's so painful. She is telling me that this is not all Palestinians. She's telling me that this is Hamas. I don't know where that level of justice comes, but I've so many people we met. We met Mr. Shamriz, who was in charge of Kibbutz Farhaza. He was the head of that group in that kibbutz, having a Gaza fund for Gazans. Every day, they collected money for an emergency for the Gazans. Every day, Gazans came to their kibbutz, found out where the house was, found out where the safe houses were, found out who lived, and they gathered all that information and they gave it to Hamas terrorists. And Mr. Shamriz, he lost his son. He had a furniture shop. And
oh, you froze. Oh no. You're frozen. I hope you could hear me, Soraya. Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and try to text Soraya and let her know that she's frozen. Hopefully she can log off and log back on. Sorry, the fun of the internet. Now I gotta find her phone number. Sorry about this. There she goes. I assume that she will log back on. Ah, at the height of the most emotional moment, of course, technology decides to do its finest. I think that the biggest disgrace of all of this is how people have either forgotten about October 7th and how we got here, or they gloss over the magnitude of the barbarism that unfolded that day. There is no excuse for the murder and the rape and the pillage and all of the things that occurred that day, burning babies alive, dismembering human beings, beheading people, raping women. This kind of savage barbarism has no place in society. And we have to remember that what we are fighting here is a just war against terror. Soraya, everything you said froze, unfortunately, right after you told the story. I think, yes.
I'm sorry on my part. It said lost connection. I don't know why.
Well, I'm glad you were able to pop back on.
So that is the story of the love we have received, the respect we have received, the care with which we are treated in the Jewish community. Nobody said to us, you're Palestinians, you're Hamas. I'm yet to hear anything like that. And I know we will never hear that. So we are hurt by what Hamas has done. And I want the people to know that it is wrong on the part of the Muslim community not to call out Hamas.
One point I do want to make, because I've been to Israel dozens of times. I have many, many, many friends there, and my sister also made Aliyah 10 years ago. 15 years ago. So I know that my opinion is biased, but I also know the people of Israel and experience what you experience, which is the level of acceptance and peacefulness is so surreal. And one thing I do want to point out is that one of the most common arguments that people have against Israel's military campaign, and I'm not talking about our critics, I'm talking about our allies, is that it's only going to further radicalize the people of Gaza. But if that were valid, it would go both ways. Why isn't anybody saying that October 7th would rapidly radicalize Israelis? Because it didn't. And you still see the peace activists in Israel, and you still see people who believe in a future of coexistence with the people of Gaza. And yes, a lot of people have lost the faith, but you don't see the terror. You don't see Israelis saying, yes, now we need to behead people. Now we need to rape and burn and pillage and dismember. It's not. People have to give everyone agency and understand that if any human chooses to be a terrorist, that is their choice. That is their doing. It is not the doing of the person who they may, or people who they may resent for whatever litany of reasons. There's a thing called civilization, and there are rules that we're supposed to abide by. So,
yes. You know, what changed our minds, Shana, was I was a part of a Muslim leadership initiative where I went to Israel about 10 years ago. And we had a dual narrative. We heard from the Palestinians, we heard from the Jews, you know, and we have firsthand stories, first principle. That is where what I guides me, you know, first principle. So what we heard, and we argued with the Jews there, why are we seeing this? What is this? Why is the checkpoint so long? And why are they keeping the Arabs so like this in line? And why are they being checked? We had a lot of questions until we went to Jenin. In Jenin, we saw signs calling for martyrs, calling for rewards. And I'm a woman, I'm a mother, that comes first to me. I cannot stand in solidarity with that kind of culture. I cannot let that culture harm another community of people. Because we know for Hamas, this is not an issue about land. If so, we could have settled this years ago. They don't want Israel to exist. And I don't know why this information has not been understood, disseminated, filtered, and debated, questioned by the majority Muslims. And I know this very much deeper, Shana, because I come from South Asia in Sri Lanka. We fought a 30-year civil war. 40,000 Sri Lankans lost their lives, and 140,000 are today missing and unaccounted for. Because you know why? The terrorist group that represented this community used these people as shields. Exactly what we are seeing with Hamas today. So, and I'm not going to stay quiet when I see that parallel. I have to call these out, you know? And just like Hamas does, they attack, they fall victim, they cry foul, and they want to maximize their own group civilian death for pity and propaganda.
Yeah,
I think we have to see an end to this.
I think you're right. Actually, now since you're talking about Sri Lanka, I'd like to delve into a little bit about the relationship between Sri Lanka and Israel, because you lived there in all your formative years in Sri Lanka. I believe you moved to America for college. Is that accurate? Or
yes, a little bit. If I had some medical issues. And I came to see a doctor, then I went to college, then I had my son, then I had my daughter. Yes.
Okay. So all of your formative years were in Sri Lanka. For people who don't know, Sri Lanka is a country that actually does maintain diplomatic ties with Israel. In fact, fun fact, Sri Lanka and Israel were founded in the same year,
Yes.
1948. Sri Lanka, in fact, was one of the first countries to recognize the state of Israel at the United Nations. But in recent decades, it's really prominently aligned with the Palestinian Authority in almost every possible forum. Now, Sri Lanka has also been the beneficiary of significant Israeli military assistance. It's definitely a complex relationship, to say the least. I'm wondering, growing up, what, if anything, were you taught about Israel and the Middle East conflict? And if you didn't learn about it in school, because a lot of people do not learn about this in school, I'm curious, excuse me, what do you feel like the average Sri Lankan thinks of Israel and the Jewish people?
Great question. If I'm to start now, after October 7th, you know, 63% of Muslims live in Asia.
Yes.
Largest community of Muslims. After October 7th, the government of Israel, nor did the Jewish organizations interrupt the narrative that was fed to them from the Arab world. And that is very, very short-sighted and very wrong. So as a result of that, Shana, sadly, in Sri Lanka today, there is a growing movement of anti-Israelism, anti-Judaism, anti-Jew. Hatred is proliferating now. In fact, this is a dangerous trend, because Bernard Lewis, when he went to Indonesia, Indonesia has the largest Muslim population. He said he saw posters of Khomeini in universities. So I have been advancing this part of my work for a very long time to the Jewish leaders I know. But if you know anybody, you need to connect me to them. We have to start a center in Asia as a hub to counter this disinformation. And I have the people. I have a team. And we are dying to begin this work, because what is told about Hamas need to be countered. So what we are looking is like an information repository. I don't even want to give our agenda publicly. I want to discuss this with Jewish organizations who will see the merit of this and support us, who are speaking so loudly, because it is, because what begins with hatred for the Jews doesn't end with that, you know. We might see in South Asia, in Asia, terror, violence, radical Islamist, jihadi terrorism. So we have to do a lot of work. So after October 7th, because the narrative was not disrupted, there is a lot of Jewish hatred. That is why when I went for a conference last year, I had to personally hire my security guards. But I did a compelling interview with a well-known TV
Yes.
show. Yes. And there I called out, I said, we don't need to learn much. Just read the Hamas charter, you know. And if you support this, look at going to a company, see their mission and vision. You should know what they're about. And if you still know this and support Hamas, there's something radically wrong with us, with the Muslims who are not willing to learn. So we are doing in some way to dispel this hatred, but we need larger efforts. And I make that appeal on your show that people
Yes.
need to support us on this.
I heard the interview. It was very clear the interviewer's biases, even though I thought she was quite respectful. I honored her for bringing you on.
Yes.
What's ironic about anti-Semitism, excuse me, that so many people don't understand is that the highest levels of anti-Semitism are in places where people have never met a Jew, which means that they're going 100% on, well, in this day and age, lies and propaganda, but hearsay. I'm curious, Soraya, when was the first time you met a Jewish person, and did it change your perspective at all? You say so beautifully, I've heard you say on numerous interviews, that you did not have to be taught not to hate Jews. You were born not to hate Jews. So I appreciate that. So I when I say, did it change your perspective? I say this with a grain of salt, but when was the first time you met a Jewish person, and did it at some point make you step back and go, wait, what? This is a Jew?
I want to address two things. You talked about people who don't know Jews. This is the concept of secondary reasoning that I mentioned. Maimonides talked about primary reasoning and secondary reasoning. What is happening in South Asia is people who have never met a Jew, who have never visited Israel, they are taking their information and facts from propaganda. So that is a huge problem. That's why I go back to saying we need a center in South Asia to address this very efficiently. When did I meet a Jew? When I took my, in Sri Lanka, this is another thing I have to tell you so proudly that Sri Lankan Muslims need to know that the first Quran in Sri Lanka was translated into Hebrew by a Jewish scholar. And you know, in Sri Lanka we have tea, right? We export one of the finest teas. The first person to bring a tea plant to Sri Lanka was a Jew. Yes, and we still have the estate called Rothschild Estate, where thousands of acres of tea planting. He started it, but the British took over. But he was the first. And then I don't know, Shana, you have to be very proud to be a Jew. Wherever the Jews went, they built schools, they built museums, they built hospitals. You know, wherever I walk in Los Angeles, every nook and corner, there's something the Jew has given to the community. So I want you to be very, I know you are proud of those facts, but when did I meet a Jew? Was when I had not met any Jews in Sri Lanka, but I heard of the Hubbard massacre in India. You know, it was tragic where terrorists from Pakistan went to India, to Mumbai, and they killed, I think I have to mention his name, Holzberg, and his wife, who was 6 months pregnant. They killed her. And then India has been such a safe haven for the Jewish people. And I hope Sri Lanka will be that, because we are a Buddhist nation. Why are we borrowing this Arab hatred? And that is my piece on education to the Sri Lankans, you know. We don't need to borrow this conflict into our lands. Buddha was very clear. He said, hostilities don't end hostilities. Only ending hostilities end hostilities. It's a very complex statement.
Yes.
And we can't continue this hostility we have towards the Jews today. We have about 20,000 Jewish tourists in Sri Lanka. There's a lot of fear mongering and all of that against the Jews. And unfortunately, though, Shana, about last week, two Jewish nationals were deported from Sri Lanka because they engaged in some assault with the locals. So we had to be very, very mindful of that kind of behavior, because it's like people are waiting with the picture to hang it, and such an incident inflames more hatred. So I don't think I still answered your question. When my son was six, I took him to a Montessori, and that's where I met many Jewish mothers. And later, after my son was told he was a terrorist, I befriended Marsha Novak, who was Jewish. And thereafter, my relationship with my Jewish friends probably flourished. And I have very close friends in Los Angeles now, including you, Shana. You're going to teach me yoga, you said. I'm waiting for that class.
I'm going to teach you yoga and drag you to my synagogue.
Yes.
Yes, I just would caution. I'm not familiar with the story that you're telling me about, but that a lot of times the context is left out. So I would, before disseminating stories like that, make sure that we're getting the full story of how this fight broke out, because I'm just going to leave it at that. But I think that, so when it comes to yoga, right? So we had a little discussion about yoga before going on air, and I smile, but really the context was how disappointing the yoga community has been, and how they've fallen over themselves to defend the terrorists of Hamas, and how brutally anti-Semitic this community has devastatingly turned out to be. It makes me equally disturbed when you talk about Sri Lanka, which again, I think most people don't know that much about Sri Lanka, but it is a majority Buddhist nation, and in a Buddhist like the yoga community are well known for being a people of peace. So what worries me about the world today is how people have become so consumed and drunk on hate that they actually think that it's love. That concerns me. I'm curious if your extraordinary level of tolerance and understanding, if you could answer this, I'm not sure if you can, is, so you have a mother who's Buddhist, a father who's Muslim, you're Muslim, your mother, as you explained to me, also converted to Islam, so that you are Muslim, but nonetheless you could take what do they say, you could take the Buddhist out of the person, we can't take the Buddhist person out of Buddhism, or in reverse, you take the person out of Buddhism, but you can't take the Buddhism out of the person. Fill in the blank with the thing of your choice. But I'm curious if your extraordinary tolerance, kindness, mindfulness, do you think it's more of a function of these Buddhist influences that you grew up with, growing up in a Buddhist country with a mother of Buddhist descent? Do you think it's Muslim influence, or do you think it's both?
All of the above, you know, because we have to understand in South Asia, we practiced a different form of Islam. We lived in harmony with other religious communities. My neighbor was Christian. My neighbor on to my left was a Buddhist. The neighbor in front was a Tamil. And we went to school. So it was a different form of Islam that we learned. Islam was not the law of the land like it is. Sharia law was not the law of the land. So we learned a very benign. Many of South Asians were very peaceful Muslims. We didn't know this kind of violence. What happened to Sri Lanka was we had an exodus of women employees who went to Middle East to earn a living, and they brought back a lot of Arab culture. And so did the country like Saudi Arabia, which has to take responsibility for proliferating this level of Wahhabi Islam that galvanized people into a very militant kind of Islam. And I want to also add to what you said earlier about Sri Lanka being a heaven and a friendly country for the Jews. The government, current government, is very, very friendly to the Jewish people. And it does a lot of business. I think we have about 20,000 Sri Lankans working in Israel.
Yes.
Yes. And one of the caregivers, she died saving a Jewish woman she was caring. And she was blind. She couldn't see. She hid her under the bed. And she came and said, only I am home. And they shot her. And the government of Israel is for this day protecting, in the sense caring for her needs, financial needs. And when this incident broke out down south about the tourists, I was very, very, I inquired into it very deeply. And I'm sure, as you said, Shana, there would have been a level of provocation that was beyond human, you know. I can understand where the whole thing would have come through and led to. So I just want you to know that the government of Israel, Sri Lanka, he has no anger, animosity, or anything towards the people of Israel and the state of Israel.
Okay.
And so do many people. I might be remiss if I don't say this. So do many people. There's deep conversation going on in Sri Lanka where people are saying this is wrong. Call out Hamas. Hamas is using babies. So therefore call Hamas to end the war. So there's a lot of conversation going on like it is in Israel. You know, people are, there's no monolithic idea or a thought. There's diversity. Yes.
Makes sense. So I don't, I want to focus on some of the really positive aspects that maybe people don't fully understand. I know I personally don't understand. So again, I'm just so amazed by your countenance, and I can't extract the fact that you are a proud Muslim woman, and this is your beliefs. I want to know what it is that you can share with us about your religion and your faith that make you most proud.
So I was raised Muslim. My grandparents were Muslim. And we had my father would always say the most important thing was one of the sayings of the prophet. He would say that you are responsible for 75 people in your community. So that was a powerful statement, and my father lived it. He was a 6'3" man, handsome, good looking, Shana, but his real beauty was in his heart. He was the kind of man who wake up every day and the first question he asks is, what can I do today for somebody? And yes, and I think he always told us, service begins when convenience ends. So I never look for a convenient space to serve, you know. My friends would tell me, when everybody says no, I am there. And so in this situation, you know, I see a deep truth that I want to speak and share with the world. So that was one of the things that we learned growing up. And we even didn't even know there was this Shia-Sunni divide. And then in the Quran, I am not a hadith person, because hadiths are contaminated Islam, written 300 years after the Prophet. Today, for the downfall of the Muslims, is this hadith culture. For everything you go into a mosque, they quote an hadith. These are man said. Even Islam, there's this concept of ijtihad, where we are supposed to come together, debate. If something is not right, we need to replace it. But sadly, the religious actors, you know, have been saying it's perfect, we cannot question it, we cannot change it. So in the Quran, there's a verse that says that we created you different so that you get to know one another. those are things we grew up learning, you know, that we have to advance, because today the image of the Muslim is being lost terribly, experientially. It's so hard to read these passages that have violence. I have to be very honest. We have violent passages in the Quran. So what? Because it's an ancient religion and it has a text. It has a context that was in which those verses were delivered. So the Muslim world has failed to give its new meaning. But the South Asian Muslim grew up differently than from the Arab Muslim. So we learned, we grew up with a lot of the Sufism. Influence of Sufism was prevalent in all the way we practiced our religion. Did I answer your question?
You didn't just answer it, but you really filled my heart. I really love that answer. So thank you so much. Your father sounds like quite a remarkable human being, and it makes sense. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I want to ask a little bit, because we're getting into all these many different aspects of your identity. You're like a diamond. You've got all these beautiful facets that shine. And I touched upon this before, but I'm curious because I put my own thoughts into like out there without asking yours. Do you feel like your feminism, you are a feminist, self-identified feminist. Do you feel like your feminism, and we've also talked about your role as a mother, but has been an influential factor in your peacemaking efforts?
Yes, being a Muslim woman has been being a minority within a minority, because being a Muslim woman who speaks up against discrimination has been very tough. So my work is very much defined by my identity as a Muslim woman, because when I speak up for the disenfranchised, the discriminated, the marginalized, the ostracized Muslim woman first within my community. That's why, unlike so many other people, we have taken every course in every country that impacts Muslim women, from Afghanistan to Iran to Pakistan, where there are 1,500 honor killings every year. And in my own country, Sri Lanka, you know, today, because there is a threat of Wahhabism that has infiltrated, Muslim women's rights are not as great as they should be. So being a Muslim woman is very important to me. And I tell this to a lot of Muslim girls, you know, we all have an agency to our Creator. For the longest time, the men, and may I say this with respect, men with beards, have told us that they are the recipients of God's message and we women are the benefactors. So therefore, we couldn't stand up to a feminist theology in the community. And we have a lot of feminist theologians, women who spoke about, looked at the Quran through the lens of feminism. And it's very powerful. It's so important to me to be a Muslim woman. Because I fight for the rights as I fight for myself. In fact, when I went to Al-Aqsa during one of my previous visits, there were some Arab guys, I think they were Palestinians, who were blocking, who keep guard the Al-Aqsa Mosque, right? I think they're from the West Bank. Because a few strands of my hair were showing, they didn't let me go into the mosque. So that is a level of the discrimination that Muslim women face within the community. So highlighting that is very important.
Yeah, you've made a lot of personal choices that have been difficult, and I've heard you say in other interviews that this is a moment where we have to decide what kind of people we are and how we hope to move forward. So how, in these trying times, would you define the kind of person you are and your path forward?
I would say we need to begin with the end in mind. And we need to create some, because today, Shana, we have problems we have created and solutions we have not explored. During, the Catholic Church, there was a time when Jew hatred was very highly rampant in the Catholic Church until the Pope said, if you are a Christian, you cannot be anti-Semitic. So in my work, I would like to see that happen. I want all the mosques to say, if you can't hate your Jewish brother, no? Because we come from the same source, Abraham. And if we are going to have all these books that say that, why don't we practice it? And I would like to really engage the Arab world, those Arab countries that broke this covenant. Now it is for them to fix it because they have power, they have influence. And I think Saudi Arabia is doing, trying to do a good job. And the Middle East, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, they're all seeing that we can't continue this way. So your question was, how do I want to see and what I'm doing towards building that world? Did I not understand your question?
The question was actually a quote directly from your mouth. So hold on, let me go back to the quote. You said that we have to decide what kind of people we are and how we hope to move forward.
Yes. So very, very, very true. We have to make a decision whether we're going to be people who will embody peace, talk peace. And for me, it's paramount that we make peace with our Jewish communities. That is very important at this particular moment.
Yes, and you referenced the Abraham Accords, or at least you alluded to them. I found it interesting that when Anila was on the show, that her organization is the only organization to join the Abraham Accords, which I didn't even think or knew no was a thing. But I want to talk about that for a moment. You of course mentioned Saudi Arabia. You didn't, I don't think you actually said the words Abraham Accords, but it was an allusion to the same, and also the list, Bahrain, UAE, Morocco. So we see these two simultaneous dynamics playing out between Israel and Islam in the Middle East and beyond throughout Africa. On one hand, we have this perpetual and violent war and hatred that dominates the landscape. But on the other, we have the Abraham Accords of friendship and cooperation and mutual understanding. I'm curious which you think will emerge in the coming years as the dominant trend. Is it going to be peace from without or war from within?
Oh, so Abraham Accords, we need more Accords. Why are we just hoping only on Abraham Accords? And I got to know the other day that we have what is called the ISAC Accords now, starting in Argentina. Did you know? I'm sure you know this 180,000 Jews live in Buenos Aires. And in 1994, the massacre of the Jews by a Hezbollah bomb. So the Argentinians are very keen on this particular peacemaking. So they brought forward the Isaac Accords. So I see the Abraham Accords as a promising path to peace. But I'm a community organizer. I also see people have to reach out and connect. They have to reach out in their communities, I don't know if you read that article I wrote, Why Haven't You Called Me After October 7th? If you have a Muslim friend, you have to hold the Muslims accountable if they have not called you. And then I would say go beyond the Muslims, get to the Christians, there we have the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Zoroastrians, Sikhs. We have to build relationships. So I don't only believe in the advocacy paradigm, not at all. I also believe in grassroots mobilizing. So just as the Abraham Accords will usher in a very promising level of peace making, through diplomacy and all of that, I think grassroots is critical.
I agree. You throw a stone in a pond and the ripple effect changes the whole world. How do we get to this point, Soraya, where condemning terrorism is actually the minority viewpoint? Peace is so much easier than war. War involves killing and energy and time and anger and money. And peace just requires turning the other cheek, walking away, and acceptance. How did we get so far from simplicity? And how did we actually get to a place in this world where terrorism has become the new resistance and the new socially acceptable norm?
I think many reasons, ignorance, we lack a code of honor, you know, where we say no matter what, this will be our foundational value and principle. My friend Shoshana Brower, she was traveling and she met this taxi driver who was Albanian, and he talked about the Albanian Muslims who saved some 2,000 Jews. Have you heard of that?
In the Holocaust?
Yes, during the Holocaust. So what did Shoshana do? She went back to Albania and she met these Muslim families who saved the Jews. And she was sharing with us her journey of meeting these Albanian families. And in Albania, Shana, they have a code called Besa. Besa means loyalty and honor. You honor the next person and you're going to be loyal. So in everything that is taught to Albanians, there's this teaching of the code of honor that I think somehow we need to come back and restill those values and those teachings to our next generation. So something like that is very hopeful to me. And for us to remember, Shana, that we can't solve Middle East peace, you know, but we can bring peace in our community, in our neighborhoods, in our families. So let's keep it small. And then when you have achieved that peace, you walk with so much light and power, you know, automatically others are going to gravitate towards you. So we don't want big, lofty ideas that we are going to solve. I certainly say, have peace with your family. Listen, and understand where the other person is coming from. Repair the ruptures in our home, in our community, and then there will be a collective conscience that will emerge. So we need some grounding values and principles moving forward.
Yeah.
Besa, we need Besa.
Besa, which leads very nicely into one of my last questions. I've skipped about five pages of questions in deference to your time, but you have said numerous times that this is your JFK moment. What does that mean to you?
Oh, JFK moment.
Sorry, I asked the hard-hitting questions.
Is it the ask? Not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for the country. And JFK also spoke about moral courage. You know, it is more difficult than it is very difficult to have moral courage. My light went off in this room. Can you see me?
I can absolutely see you.
So I think both of them put together, my JFK moment would be to ask, what can I do for my country at this moment, and what can I do for marginalized, ostracized people who are misunderstood? And that would be currently my work centers around combating Jew hatred.
Yes. Can you tell me one or two of your biggest wins in this combat or in the bridge building front in general?
You know, we had many wins. Now we have taken many steps back and we are rebuilding those wins. One of the greatest wins for me, I would say, is like 2 days ago, I had a letter from a girl who was wearing a hijab, who wears a hijab. She said how much she values my work, but she's unable to come out and really stand by me in public. So I'm hoping that I'm planting, sowing the seeds for many such voices to come up when it is safe. Because not everybody will take a chance and can take a chance. I understand situations. So that I consider as really heart-centered work for me, to speak my truth. Because when I do, I give permission for somebody else to speak their truth. That I find as something very rewarding and very personally, very uplifting and satisfying in my work.
And let me just say that when everyone starts speaking up, nobody will have to be afraid to speak up anymore. I do want to say that there a comment just came in on the chat, which I actually was the last line in my Substack last night. So I don't know if this is a reference to that, but it said, "Do you believe in magic?" Such broad implications. I don't know if that means that peace can only come through magic, or if we believe that miracles exist. I do believe in miracles, and I do believe that miracles are magical. And one thing I can say when it comes to the future of Jewish-Islamic relations is that if anybody could have imagined the relationship that Israel has with Germany 80 years ago, they would have been considered crazy. And yet anything that can turn on a dime in one direction can turn on a dime in the other. And I do hope that there is an awakening and that more and more connections, one-on-one connections, because it's true what you say, it's the personal connections, not just the listening to our role models and heroes, that really start touching lives. Soraya, where can people find you and how can they best support your work?
Oh, thank you, Shana. On that regard, I believe in miracles. Miracles happen to me every day. And my friend and colleague says, every setback is a setup for a comeback. We must have hope. We must believe in miracles. And not blindly, and we must work towards it. We have to contribute. We have to be the change that we want to see in the world. And for me, if I am a peacemaker, not a hater, that's a huge shift in my journey. So I think that we all need to remember that. We need to, when we look at the mirror, you see a mess. You might see a reflection of your of the room you're in, and if that room is messy, you see it in the mirror. You can't clean the mirror. You have to clean inside. So that is a powerful message I say. No matter who's against you, there is a source and power that will stand with you if you can embody that level of calmness. And that's what yoga teaches, you know, the oneness of the mind and the body. So finding me, you know, I run a Muslim Women Speakers Bureau because I believe, like, and I think Melinda Gates said, a woman with a mic is a powerful woman. So, so I want to amplify my Muslim women's voices. I work with Anila at AMVAC. We want to come to your events. We want to speak. For me, I was talking to a huge Jewish organization yesterday. I said, I want, like in Albania, where there were Muslims who stood for the Jews, I want the Jewish youth to know there are Muslim women who are standing with them. I want them to grow with that knowing so that 50 years later, they will tell their children, oh yeah, there are about some Muslim women who stood up for us, you know. I want to be that in that story. So invite us to speak at your events. We can do Zoom calls. We can come see you. And I do a grassroots mobilization. I do a lot of work with my friend Julie Marzouk. She's Jewish. and she's a lawyer. She has fought tooth and nail at the Irvine City Council. That's another school. You know what happens there. And
Yeah, I'm actually originally from Irvine and my parents are still there. I'm very aware of what's going on in Irvine. It's very disturbing.
so we go together, we work, we have this program called the Jewish Leadership Initiative, Interfaith Initiative. So she teaches some skills and I teach some skills. And us coming together alone is the most powerful message we want both all youth to have. So I have the website called MuslimWomenSpeakers.com. You can donate to our cause there because I need to do a little bit more work with social media. You know, I want to feature all my women speakers and, you know, everything hinges on whom you hire, how expensive that is. So support us to amplify Muslim voices.
I believe that, I mean, Anila, who's been on my show, is in your group, and so is Dalia Zaida, who's going to be on my show next week. So we've got a triumvirate of you beautiful, strong women coming on the show. But I will also, I don't believe that was in the list of links that you gave me for the show notes. I will add it. And if there are any other organizations that you want me to add in the show notes, please send them to me. I could add them right away. My last question for you today, Soraya, is what do the words Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
Oh, okay. It means a lot. I'm one of the people who first started using that word, you know, that it says, I think people of Israel should live. And I say people of Israel should live and thrive. You live and thrive because you taught us many worldly lessons. Take the lesson of David and Goliath, you know. We are in a situation like this. We are all the Davids. We all should have that slingshot. So Am Yisrael Chai, from me to you, the people of Israel should not live, but they must live and thrive. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Soraya, it's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you join me on the show today. I know that a lot of people are going to have a great awakening from listening to your heartfelt words. So that being said, salam alaikum. How do you say the second word? Alaikum?
Shalom alaikum.
Oh, when you mix it together. Shalom alaikum. That's your special Muslim Jewish greeting. I love it. Shalom alaikum. And Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you again so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.